From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, were the Paris terrorists acting as so-called lone wolves? Thousands stage a peaceful protest in defense of free expression in France. The U.S. promises to help French authorities in any possible way. A Vietnamese lawmaker is arrested over alleged fraud. And researchers have a new lead on why HOV is so hard to cure. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. France is observing a day of mourning today following Wednesday's mass shooting at the Paris office of the Charlie Hebdo weekly magazine, in which 12 people, including the publication's editor and two policemen, were killed. One of three suspects has surrendered to police. World leaders have universally condemned the attack by three black-clad gunmen who forced their way into the office and summarily executed eight journalists, a visitor and maintenance employee, and escaped midday. France has raised its terror alert system to the highest level and bolstered security. Greg Barton of the Center for Islam and Modern World at Australia's Monash University told VOA's Victor Beattie he believes the three gunmen were acting as so-called lone wolves, not at the behest of any specific terrorist organization.
The definition point here is whether they act as part of an organization following central command or whether they're acting spontaneously of their own volition. And it's not a clear demarcation. The 7/7 attacks in July 2005, the London subway system, involved four people acting fairly autonomously. They, you know, begin to look like lone wolf attackers. More recently, we've seen in France attacks by Mohamed Merah in 2002, in the south of France, in Toulouse and Montbun, and then last year, Mehdi Namouche, a French national, shooting dead four people in a Jewish museum in Brussels. Those are classic lone wolf attacks. This appears to be of the same kind, but it's of a level of sophistication we don't normally think of as associated with lone wolf attacks.
One police official is quoted by the Associated Press as saying they were linked to a Yemeni terrorist organization, and a witness said he heard one, quote, "You can tell the media that it's Al-Qaeda in Yemen."
That's right. The woman who was forced to key in the door code for them, they threatened to shoot her infant daughter, said that they said, "We are acting in the name of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula." This is that affiliate of Al-Qaeda, known to be most aggressive in attempting to launch foreign attacks. But in the past, their attempts, such as the bombing of the flight into Detroit Christmas Day 2009, the so-called underwear bombing, involve explosive devices. So this would be an innovation to be using assault weapons if indeed it's proven that there is this link. But even then, it's not clear whether this was centrally planned by AQAP or whether these people took it upon themselves to do this in the name of AQAP. We think that they had experience fighting with Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, where they were further radicalized and where they learned how to use these assault weapons so effectively. So this classification of lone wolf or organized terror attack is an important point of distinction that's not clear at this moment.
You mentioned Islamic State fighters returning from Iraq and Syria. Does Europe have a growing problem with regard to these fighters, and what can be done about it?
The entire world has a growing problem with these foreign fighters, but it's particularly a problem in Europe. It's not clear the number of people who have traveled from America to fight with Syria in Syria and Iraq, but it may be of the order of 100. In the case of France, it's closer to 1,000. In the case of the UK, more than 600. So very large numbers. Admittedly, France has a Muslim population of around 5 million. Most of whom, of course, are well-integrated and very moderate. But it has a lot of disgruntled young men who are being radicalized through a life in petty crime, time in prison, and then joining up with groups and fighting abroad. And that fits what we know about the alleged gunmen, the two brothers involved in this attack, fits with the pattern of people like Mehdi Namouche last year and Mohamed Merah in 2012.
European states are assessing their threat levels. Of course, France has raised it to its highest level. How can European governments respond?
There's no easy answers here. There's no singular solutions. This office of the magazine Charlie Hebdo was secured behind a locked door, had a police guard. That wasn't enough. I mean, it had been attacked by firebombers in 2011, so you know, there was reason to keep it under high security. Al-Qaeda had its editor on its watch list and threatened to kill him in a issue of its magazine Inspire, linked with AQAP, back in 2013. So these people were as secure as you could reasonably make a group of journalists working in a professional environment. So that's not going to be the answer. Intelligence is our best line of defence. The most important element of intelligence is human intelligence, and that really depends upon good relations with communities. Still no guarantees there, but a better chance of being forearmed that somebody is about to try and do something if you're sort of plugged into community networks.
Barton says modern terrorist organizations launch such outrageous attacks in hopes of inflaming anti-immigrant sentiments against Muslims, which in turn makes Muslim communities feel threatened, thereby radicalizing young Muslim men, making them ripe for recruitment in jihadist groups. He says anti-Islam rallies in Germany underscore the concern such tactics are working. However, he says he's encouraged that thousands of others are taking up the rallying cry of Jesus Charlie or I am Charlie. Barton says the world needs to unite against terrorism rather than split along religious or ethnic lines. Thousands of people have staged a peaceful protest in defense of free expression in France. Lisa Bryant has details from Paris.
The Place de la République in central Paris was packed on Wednesday evening. Candles decked the giant statue of Marianne, the symbol of France and of liberty. Many protesters chanted free expression and Charlie Hebdo. That's the name of the satirical French weekly assaulted earlier in the day. Armed gunmen shot dead 12 people at its Paris office and wounded several others before escaping.
Et c'est pourquoi demain sera une journée...
In a televised address, French President François Hollande declared Thursday would be a day of mourning. The entire republic has been attacked, he said, and its values of free expression, democracy, peace, and tolerance. France's best defense is unity. That unity was on display at the Place de la République. Agathe Bayeurt was there with her mother, Catherine.
On est quand même dans un pays où on peut dire ce qu'on pense.
Bayeurt said France was a country where people could say what they think, and she was there to defend that right. Retired history professor François Maréchal arrived at the rally clasping an old copy of Charlie Hebdo. The satirical weekly may have been targeted for mocking Islam, but Maréchal was holding an old edition that mocked Christianity.
Donc c'est contre tous les intégrismes.
Maréchal said he joined many here in denouncing fundamentalism in all its forms. The assailants, he said, have killed some of the best cartoonists in France. Leaders from around the world have denounced the attack, which is France's deadliest in decades. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The United States is condemning the terror attack in Paris, and officials are promising to help in any way possible. VOA's Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
Meeting with his vice president and secretary of state, President Barack Obama praised France as America's oldest ally and offered U.S. help to hunt down those who carried out the attack.
Our counterterrorism cooperation with France is excellent. We will provide them with every bit of assistance that we can.
Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned terrorists the U.S. and France will never give in.
Today's murders are part of a larger confrontation, not between civilizations, no, but between civilization itself and those who are opposed to a civilized world.
At the Pentagon, another offer of support from spokesman Colonel Steve Warren.
A horrific, terrible attack. There is no place among free people for this type of barbarism. And we stand with our allies. We stand absolutely ready to assist the French in any way.
Warren says the Pentagon is not aware of specific threat streams right now, and there have been no requests from France for any military assistance. U.S. Homeland Security officials also say they're closely monitoring the events, but add there's no change to America's security posture. The U.S. Embassy in Paris also remains open. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Speaking in the House of Commons Wednesday, British Prime Minister David Cameron addressed the Paris attack.
I know that this House and this country stands united with the French people in our opposition to all forms of terrorism, and we stand squarely for free speech and democracy. And these people will never be able to take us off those values.
At the United Nations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke with reporters.
This horrific attack is meant to divide. We must not fall into that trap. This is a moment for solidarity around the world. We must stand strong for freedom of expression and tolerance and stand against the forces of division and hate.
The Committee to Protect Journalists called the shooting the worst on the media since the 2009 massacre in the Philippines, in which 57 people, including journalists, were killed. Muslim leaders in France have also denounced the shooting. Chinese President Xi Jinping has pledged to increase cooperation with Latin America and the Caribbean as he opened a forum in Beijing with leaders from the region. The meeting between Mr. Xi and leaders of some 30 Community for Latin American and Caribbean states comes as China pushes for more influence in what has traditionally been Washington's backyard. Mr. Xi said the two-way trade between China and Latin America was expected to rise to $500 billion in 10 years. China has particularly strong ties with several Latin American nations that have clashed diplomatically with the U.S., especially Venezuela. A member of Vietnam's National Assembly was arrested late Wednesday over an alleged real estate scam. Marion Brown reports from Hanoi.
Police searched the home of 49-year-old Cho Thị Thu Nga for several hours Wednesday, seizing an undisclosed number of documents. She was arrested over alleged fraud involving a housing project run by her private company. The company collected deposits from 80 potential home buyers between 2009 and 2010, worth a total of $14 million, but did not pay them back when the project did not materialise, a report in Tang Nian newspaper said. It was expected to be finished by the end of 2015. Nguyen Minh Thuyết, former deputy chairman of the National Assembly's Committee on Culture, Education and Youth, said some negative information about Nga began circulating at the beginning of the assembly election process in 2011. However, he says relevant agencies probably did not investigate this thoroughly, and the electorate voted her in. She was suspended on Wednesday from her position as a member of the National Assembly's Committee on Finance and Budget. Lawmakers in Vietnam are allowed a level of immunity from prosecution, as Dick Xuân Thảo, chairman of the National Assembly's Legislative Research Institute, explained in an interview with state broadcaster VTV on Thursday. He says according to the Constitution, no one is allowed to arrest, detain or prosecute a deputy without approval from the National Assembly. In Nga's case, chairman of the Assembly, Nguyen Sinh Hung, gave permission for investigation agencies to go ahead. The government has been carrying out a crackdown on corruption in recent years amid economic woes, with several high-profile trials, some of which have resulted in the death penalty. Observers often connect the arrests of prominent business figures with political infighting in the Communist Party. Deputy Thuyết said he believed this was not the case with Nga. Police gathered enough evidence against her, he says, and have already arrested her partners. Vietnam is rated 119 out of 175 countries in Transparency International's Corruption Perception Index 2014, ranking it ahead of Cambodia and Myanmar, but behind Thailand, Indonesia and China. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Researchers have a new lead on why HIV has been so hard to cure and a potential new strategy for driving the virus from one of its last major hiding places in the body. VOA's Steve Barragona has the story.
Patients can live for decades with HIV infection as long as they take antiviral drugs that stop the virus from making copies of itself, known as replicating. But the virus is never gone. It lies dormant in a part of the immune system called resting memory T cells, making it basically invisible to the body's defenses. But Johns Hopkins University HIV researcher Robert Silicano says,
as soon as patients stop taking the drugs, virus comes out of this latent state and starts to replicate again. And that's why you can't cure anybody with the drugs.
Silicano spoke to VOA by Skype. He says doctors have hoped that if they can decloak the virus while the patient is taking antivirals, the body's own defenses would spot the infected cells and destroy them, and the drugs would keep the newly awakened virus from spreading. But so far, that has not worked. Writing in the journal Nature, Silicano and colleagues found one reason.
Almost all of this virus that's in a latent form has mutated in a way that makes it able to escape.
HIV is a master of disguise, like a spy on the run. Secret agents can change their coat and color their hair. They might duck into a closet until the coast is clear. Likewise, HIV is constantly mutating to evade the immune system. That's where the drugs come in. If the virus fools the body's germ hunters, called killer T cells, the antiviral drugs can still kill it, except for the altered virus that has gone into hiding in the memory T cells. The new study found that when the virus comes out of hiding, nearly all of it is mutated, still wearing a disguise that most of the killer T cells do not recognize. Most, but not all. And that's the key.
There are other cells that see different parts of the virus that have not mutated. And those cells still can be effective. Now, they have to be stimulated in the right way. But once they're stimulated, they can now recognize and eliminate these infected cells.
Silicano showed this smaller group of killer T cells a piece of the virus that had not changed. That stimulated them to find and kill most of the infected memory T cells. It's like training spy hunters to look for the secret agent's shoes. It's good news, but Siciliano cautions it's too soon to celebrate.
Whether they would ever kill enough of them, you know, to allow the patient to go off treatment and not have the virus come back, we don't know.
But according to virologist David Margolis at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who was not involved in the research, it's a brighter assessment than a study Silicano published just a few years ago.
It sort of painted a darker picture, like it would be very hard or impossible to get rid of latently infected cells. It does look pretty straightforward to think of ways that we could retarget the immune response to actually clear that virus.
But, he adds, there are major hurdles to clear before scientists can talk about a cure for HIV. Silicano agrees.
Half the battle is killing the cells once, you know, you turn the virus back on. Probably the harder part is actually just turning the virus back on. We still, you know, are looking for ways to do that.
Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
According to the World Health Organization, 128 million people were infected with malaria in 2013, a year that saw 584,000 die, most under the age of five. And now, Lan Shen, a London-based tech startup firm, claims that its X-Rapid app for smartphones and an attachable microscope case could significantly increase diagnosis rates. Jean Veribabel is the company's chief executive.
The problem to solve is how to diagnose malaria quickly and cheaply. This is a mobile microscope, 200-time microscope, with a constant source of light attached to an iPhone or an Android device, any of them. And we use the combined power of the smartphone's camera and the smartphone processing power to read a malaria slide like a biologist would do, just faster and more efficiently. And therefore, we can diagnose malaria on the spot where it's needed. And the faster you diagnose, the faster you can treat it.
The WHO said in West Africa, the Ebola outbreak has had a devastating impact on malaria treatment and the rollout of malaria control programs. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 8, 1642, Florentine scientist Galileo Galilei died. The physicist, mathematician, astronomer, and philosopher is known as the father of modern observational astronomy. On this date, in 1790, President George Washington sent the first State of the Union address to the U.S. Congress. In 1815, 2 weeks after a treaty ended the War of 1812, Major General Andrew Jackson led a small, poorly equipped army to victory against a superior British force at the Battle of New Orleans. Jackson became a national hero and later was elected President of the United States. In 1825, American inventor Eli Whitney died. Whitney revolutionized the mass production of cotton with his cotton gin. In 1916, Allied forces had to stage a retreat from the shores of the Turkish Gallipoli Peninsula, ending a disastrous invasion of the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. In 1918, President Woodrow Wilson, in an address to the U.S. Congress, unveiled his 14 points aimed at maintaining peace in Europe following World War I. In 1935, rock and roll pioneer Elvis Presley was born. On this date in 1956, Elvis's Don't Be Cruel Hound Dog single went to number one and stayed there for 11 weeks. In 1956, five American missionaries were attacked and killed by members of an isolated tribe in Ecuador. On this day in 1976, Zhou Enlai died. Zhou served as China's premier for nearly 25 years and helped facilitate improved relations with the United States. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Workers in Peru and the Philippines will have enhanced protection through a partnership with the United States. The United States Department of Labor's Bureau of International Labor Affairs, or ILAB, on December 22nd announced two grants to help strengthen the government's enforcement of existing labor laws in Peru and the Philippines through technical assistance projects to build capacity at the labor inspectorates in those countries. In Peru, the United States awarded $2 million to Capital Humano y Social Alternativo, a nonprofit organization that will help build the labor law enforcement capacity of the Peruvian Ministry of Labor and Employment Promotions, or MTPE, newly formed National Superintendency of Labor Inspection. The project will focus on improving the MTPE's enforcement of laws, regulations, and other legal instruments governing subcontracting, outsourcing, and the use of short-term employment contracts, especially in the country's non-traditional export sectors such as mining, agriculture, fishing, and textiles. In the Philippines, a grant of $1 million is intended to help improve the effectiveness of labor inspections, particularly in the area of occupational safety and health and labor rights monitoring by workers, employers, and their representatives. The Philippines has taken a number of steps to increase staff and enhance technology in the labor inspectorate. To assist in these efforts, the grant awarded to the International Labor Organization will help improve labor law compliance and labor rights monitoring. Since 1995, ILAB has worked with other governments and international organizations to identify assistance that countries may require to improve the labor conditions of their workers. ILAB currently provides $76 million in technical assistance to improve worker rights, livelihoods, and labor law compliance in more than 72 countries around the world. Labor inspections as a means of enforcing existing labor laws are essential to raising standards for workers around the world, said Deputy Undersecretary for International Labor Affairs Carol Peer. These projects will build on existing efforts within Peru and the Philippines to help those countries better enforce their labor laws and protect workers' rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Manila, VOA DC.